I've been invited to speak to you on the question, can science explain everything? And the material for this talk was researched partly for a recent book with the same title, but also partly for a lecture I gave at the British Academy in London on what I call scientific fundamentalism. And we shall come to that a little bit later. But the topic has always interested me. Can science explain everything? Well, of course, being a pure mathematician, I need to start with definitions, at least some. What do we mean by science? Well, etymologically, it comes from the Latin word scientia, or the verb scire, to know, scio, I know. And originally the word science came into the English language through William Whewell in the 1880s. But it earlier meant scientia, knowledge of all kinds. And we need to bear that in mind, because nowadays in the English-speaking world, science means exclusively almost the natural sciences, physics, chemistry, biology, and so on, as contrasted with the humanities, literature, languages, history, philosophy, and theology. But the older meaning is still around, sometimes explicitly, and at other times covertly. For example, in German, the word Wissenschaft is coming from the word Wissen, to know, ich weiß, I know, means science in the scientia, in the old sense. And the Germans divide it contemporarily into two: Naturwissenschaft, that's the natural sciences, physical chemistry, and then the Geisteswissenschaften, and they are the humanities. And the people have difficulties, as in the translation of my recent book, to use Wissenschaft, because the title actually is about Naturwissenschaft. Now, what we're going to be talking about tonight is the view that science can explain everything. And we call that scientism. Science is the only way to truth. And the philosopher Bertrand Russell once gave what is a very useful definition of scientism, although, to be fair to him, he didn't fully subscribe to this himself. I quote, "Whatever knowledge is attainable must be attained by scientific methods. And what science cannot discover, mankind cannot know." Now this bears a bit of analysis. What does he mean by science? Whatever knowledge is attainable must be attained by scientific methods. Now, if you're thinking of science in the old sense of knowledge, then of course this is the tautology. That kind of methodology is the only way to get to know anything at all. But often this is taken to refer to the natural sciences only. And then you see the statement is logically incoherent in the following sense. This statement, what science cannot tell us, mankind cannot know, is it the statement of the natural sciences? No. Well, then it refutes itself, because if it's true, it's false. Then it's too late in the evening for this kind of logic, but we're going to get a bit more of it, I can assure you. The scientism as such tends to go together with exaggerated truth claims. And that's why I call it scientific fundamentalism, because it bears all the marks of the fundamentalisms of which we're much more aware in other spheres. But it's the epistemological belief that the natural sciences alone can deliver truth, that all valid knowledge is science in that sense, so that in the end, science becomes coextensive with rationality. And in the Encyclopedia of Religion and Science, philosopher Michael Stenmark says, while the doctrines that are described as scientism have many possible forms and various degrees of ambition, they share the idea that the boundaries of science, that is, typically note the natural sciences, could and should be expanded so that something that has not been previously considered as a subject pertinent to science can now be understood as part of science, usually with science becoming the sole or the main arbiter regarding this area. So the strongest form of scientism states that science has no boundaries, all human problems and all aspects of human endeavour in due time will be dealt with and solved by science alone. It is a form of intellectual imperialism. And our local professor of physical chemistry, with whom I have had several debates, as you can see on the internet, Peter Atkins, he defends this with great vigour. My own faith, he writes, please notice that. Faith is not just a religious concept, and it certainly does not mean believing where you know there is no evidence. Faith is a normal concept. It means what we believe, what we trust, and all of us have a worldview that we believe in. Here's Atkins' worldview. My scientific faith is that there is nothing that the scientific method cannot illuminate. That's reasonable enough. But there's nothing that the scientific method cannot elucidate. Well, we shall think about that. And he expands it elsewhere by saying, there's no reason to suppose that science cannot deal with every aspect of existence. Only the religious, among whom I include not only the prejudiced but the uninformed, hope that there's a dark corner of the physical universe or of the universal experience that science can never hope to illuminate. But science has never encountered a barrier, and the only grounds for supposing that reductionism will fail are pessimism on the part of scientists and fear in the minds of the religious. He's referring to the idea that not only can natural sciences explain everything, but they will do it reductionalistically. In other words, everything can be explained ultimately in terms of physics and chemistry. And of course, you notice the fundamentalist tones of what Atkins says, only the ignorant will reject our view. Now, I've read Peter Atkins with great interest because I debated him. And I think he's one of these people who shifts between two definitions of science, so he's hard to catch. Because, for example, in his more recent book, On Being, he writes, in short, I stand by my claim that the scientific method is the only means of discovering the nature of reality. And although its current views are open to revision, the approach, making observations and comparing notes, will forever survive as the only way of acquiring reliable knowledge. Now, of course, making observation and comparing notes is a very reliable way of acquiring knowledge. I couldn't agree with him more. But that's the old meaning of science. He's not mentioning the physical sciences here at all. So if that's the case, we've nothing to discuss. Science in that sense can explain everything, because explanation means that we're gaining knowledge and understanding. And if you define science to be the way in which we gain knowledge and understanding, then by definition science explains everything, so we can stop at our own. But that's not the issue with many of these people. The current meaning of science in the English-speaking world, if it's true that the natural sciences explain everything, then tomorrow we'd have to shut half the faculties in this university. Literature, history, economics, ethics, philosophy, theology, art, music, would all have to stop. They're not natural science. But now here's the important thing. They are rational disciplines. Rationality, the use of reason, and the approach that's often described as the scientific method, making observations, hypotheses, testing them, is something that applies to a far greater realm, a far greater number of intellectual disciplines, in fact all of them, than the natural sciences themselves. Now, one of the most famous people advocating the primacy of the natural sciences was the late Stephen Hawking. He was just ahead of me at Cambridge, and I remember him walking around when the first signs of motor neurone disease appeared. Stephen Hawking was a mathematical genius. There's no question about it. And it is, of course, fascinating to read what he writes. And his co-authored book, The Grand Design, began with a list of the kind of questions that I loved since I was a boy. The big questions. And here they are from his book. How can we understand the world in which we find ourselves? How does the universe behave? What is the nature of reality? Where did it all come from? Did the universe need a creator? Why do we exist? Why this particular set of laws and not some other? And then the grand question, why is there something rather than nothing? And I thought this is going to be very interesting to hear how one of the great minds, mathematical minds of our age, handles these big questions. But then he drops the bombshell. Traditionally, he says, these are questions for philosophy. But philosophy is dead. It has not kept up with modern developments in science, particularly in physics. As a result, scientists, and you can see what he means by that, have become the bearers of the torch of discovery in our quest for knowledge. Now that is scientism with a vengeance. But now the interesting thing to do is ask, what actually, which of these questions can the natural sciences answer? And you find, with a moment's thought, that less than half of them come into question. Certainly the natural sciences can tackle how does the universe behave? And it tackles partially our understanding of the world. And it can begin to address the nature of the laws. But why do we exist? Science cannot answer. Why is there something rather than nothing it cannot answer? Although we've come back to that question. You see, one of the great ironies about this book is that having declared that philosophy is dead, near the beginning of his book, the rest of the book is about the philosophy of science. And I repeat, Hawking was a brilliant physicist. But as a philosopher, there's much left to be desired here. And he thinks that all these questions could be solved by the natural sciences. So let's look briefly at the attempted solution of the big question that Leibniz and Wittgenstein and Heidegger and various others thought about. Why is there something rather than nothing? So here's the answer. On the scale of the entire universe, the positive energy of the matter can be balanced by the negative gravitational energy, and so there is no restriction on the creation of the whole universes. And here's the key statement in the entire book. Because there is a law like gravity, the universe can and will create itself from nothing. I had a preview of this book because someone wanted me to comment on it. And when I read that sentence, I stopped and I thought, just a moment. Because there is a law like gravity, that is because there is something. The universe can and will create itself from nothing. Well, elementary logic would tell you that is a beautiful example of a flat contradiction. Because there is something, the universe can create itself from nothing. But then I probed a bit further, I notice that he does not say because gravity exists. He says because there's a law of gravity. Now, I presume he must mean that gravity exists. But I just got a bit of caution because of something he said in his earlier bestseller, A Brief History of Time. This idea that some people have that laws are creative. Peter Atkins, I mentioned, I once had a little exchange with him here in Oxford after a debate. I wasn't involved in it. But I asked him what created the universe. And he said, mathematics. And I was so taken aback by this, I'm afraid I was rather rude and I laughed. I just couldn't help myself. And he said, why are you laughing? I said, really, Peter, I'm sorry, but that must be the silliest thing I, as a mathematician, have heard for a long time. He said, why? Well, I said, look, 1 + 1 = 2. Did that ever put £2 in your pocket? Now, this is quite important, actually. I owe this to C.S. Lewis, as many other things. But you know, you remember the financial crisis? You probably suffered from it, as I did. I'm told that that happened because some people thought that by doing clever sums and mathematics, you could create money. But you cannot do that. But listen to Paul Davis, with whom I discuss these things. There's no need. He's talking about the universe. Remember, Hawking is giving us his reason for dismissing God as a possible solution to the question, why is there something rather than nothing? That's what he's trying to get across to us. There is a science answer to the question. Paul Davis wrote, there's no need to invoke anything supernatural in the origin of the universe or of life. I have never liked the idea of divine tinkering. For me, it's much more inspiring to believe that a set of laws, mathematical laws, can be so clever as to bring all these things into being. That's sheer nonsense. Newton's laws of motion that I used to love to teach to undergraduates, they never moved a billiard ball in the history of the universe. People with cues do that. The laws describe the motion. And the laws certainly never created a billiard ball. You see, it's very important when we think of scientific explanation in terms of law that we realize that these laws, very important as they are, set in mathematics, are not creative. They're not causes. They are descriptions, and we'll go into that a bit later, of what normally happens. But now there's more. The universe will create itself. Now what does that mean? If I say to you, X creates Y, you will have a rough idea that if you've got X, you can somehow produce Y. But if I say X creates X, what does that mean? Well, frankly, I think it means that nonsense remains nonsense, even if scientists write it. It is absolutely nonsensical. And what is more, the universe will create itself from nothing. What do you mean by nothing? Then you said there's no problem, it's the absence of anything. Oh, is it? Well, in order to get a universe from nothing, I've noticed that Hawking and others have to redefine nothing. This is the Lawrence Krauss, an astrophysicist, in his book, A Universe from Nothing. I quote, surely nothing is every bit as physical as something, especially if it is to be defined as the absence of something. What? I mean, if a 12-year-old wrote that, what would you say? You'd cross it out and say, this is logical nonsense. And this concerns me, ladies and gentlemen. Here are serious minds. In their energy to get rid of any God concept, and their arguments aren't even arguments, they're simply logical incoherence. And that really does disturb me, because now we hit a big problem. And I put it this way. One of the things we need to learn in the science-God debate is not every statement by a scientist is a statement of science. And this, the universe will create itself from nothing, is not a statement of science at all. It's a statement by a scientist. It represents his belief, even though it in itself is unintelligible. Now, that worries me because it means that there's a serious weakness here. And who am I to say, you know, you'd be sitting there thinking, gosh, Lennox is a minnow compared with Hawking. Absolutely, I agree with that. I wish Stephen had won the Nobel Prize before he died. But nobody actually managed to prove the existence of Hawking radiation before he did die. But maybe one day they will do it. But you see, we're coming to philosophy, and that's a completely different discipline. Let's take Christ first. Comment by Massimo Pugliuzzi, who's a philosopher. This shows two things. Christ does not understand what the business of philosophy is, and he was attacked for this, and he's had to soften his position. But Hawking, who's a friend of the British Astronomer Royal, Baron Rees of Ludlow, who has written papers with Hawking, he was asked by the Guardian what he thought of Hawking's pronouncement that the creation of the universe did not require God. Now, Rees is not a theist, but he said this: I know Stephen Hawking well enough to know that he has read little philosophy and less theology, so I don't think his views should be taken any special weight. The trouble is, because of his justified authority in science, people think that he solved the problem by natural science, how we get something from nothing. You know, it reminds me, and Krauss and Hawking both lend weight to a statement once made by Albert Einstein: the scientist is a poor philosopher. But let's listen to some other scientists. Take Lord Winston, for instance. Science is not about certainty. Science is about probability. Science is not about absolutes. We scientists give the impression that science is about the truth. It's not. It's about what is most likely. Now that's bringing us right down to earth here. A Nobel laureate, Sir Peter Medawar, and there are buildings named after him here in Oxford, wrote a wonderful little book, Advice to a Young Scientist, that's well worth reading. And in it, he says that the claim that science is the only way to truth is a claim unworthy of science itself. I quote, "There is no quicker way for a scientist to bring discredit upon himself and upon his profession that roundly to declare that science knows, or soon will know, the answers to all questions worth asking, and that questions which do not admit a scientific answer are in some way non-questions." And you see, science has been phenomenally successful, but it would be a great pity, in my view, if the kind of Hawking hubris and a fundamentalist attitude to it were to rob young people, particularly, of the importance of the arts in all their richness and ability to deal with questions that the natural sciences cannot deal with. Questions of meaning, for example. And following Medawar, I would suggest that the confusion of scientism with science is perhaps one of the main reasons why certain sections of the public regard science with some suspicion. But now, Medawar pushes on with this. I quote again, "The existence of a limit to science is made clear by its inability to answer childlike elementary questions having to do with first and last things, such as how did everything begin? What are we all here for? What's the point of living?" Those are some of Hawking's questions. He adds, "Doctrinaire positivism, now something of a period piece, dismissed all such non-questions or pseudo-questions, that only simpletons ask and only the gullible profess to be able to answer. Metawar does not, of course, mean that science does the main work and there's a little bit left over for the other disciplines. No. He says there are things that science, the natural sciences, cannot answer or explain. In fact, logic and mathematics is one example, values and ethical beliefs another. Aesthetic experience and science cannot even explain itself. You can illustrate the limits of the natural sciences very easily. Imagine my Aunt Matilda, and she's made a cake. And I want you to imagine you've all won the Nobel Prize in various scientific disciplines. So here's Aunt Matilda, here's her cake. And it's sitting on the podium. And I ask you to analyze the cake. So the physicist will analyze it in terms of atoms and quarks and elementary particles, and the chemist in terms of chemical elements, and the biologist in terms of the various biological materials that are in it, and so on and so forth. And then we end up with a huge volume of information about the cake. And then I thank you all very much, Nobel Prize winners all. I have one last question for you. Why did she make the cake? What can a physicist say? As a physicist, nothing. What can you say as a biologist? Nothing. And here's the interesting thing. You'll never know unless she reveals it to you. Now here's something very important that we need to think about. If she does reveal it to you, how will she do it? Well, normally by talking. Now, your science cannot reach the reason for making the cake. But now, when she reveals it to you by telling you, will you shut off your reason at that point? Of course you won't. You need your reason to understand what she says. Even though the thing is inaccessible by your reason. Because however sophisticated your brain scanning equipment is, you can tell her brain story, how her brain lights up, but you can't tell what's in her mind. You as a neuroscientist can tell me what's in my brain. You can't tell me what's in my mind. I can't tell what's in my brain, but I can tell you what's in my mind. The brain story and the mind story are separate. And this little illustration is not so innocent as you think. Because you see, if we cannot determine the meaning of a cake or its purpose from scientific analysis, we're not going to be able to do that at the bigger scale of the universe, are we? But if there is a maker who has revealed it to us, then that's a different matter. We can use our reason on any claim to a revelation. And of course you know now what I'm hinting at. The revelation on which I've based my entire life to this point. The Bible, which deals with these things seriously. We use our reason on it. We don't shut our reason off, but we can't produce what's in there by our reason. So that's just a little helpful way of looking at this kind of thing. The cosmologist George Ellis, talking about the essential nature of scientific fundamentalism and other fundamentalism, says a partial truth is proclaimed as a whole truth. Only one viewpoint is allowed on any issue, all others are false. This dogmatism is combined with an inability to relate understanding to context. And Ellis regards this as a major problem. And there are certain questions that you can't ask. And often, if you even mention God in public, nobody will take it seriously because they've decided long ago that science has buried God. But we must now move on a little bit and come to some questions about what do we mean by explanation. We thought briefly about the question, science explain everything, but what do we actually mean by explanation? And it's not so easy. There's a vast literature on the nature of science itself. In what ways does science explain? Well, of course, one way is in terms of laws and mechanisms. Think of Newton and his discovery of gravity. And let's take the law of gravity as an example, because one of the fascinating things about it is this, that Newton, who discovered the law of gravity, was a theist. He believed in God. Stephen Hawking did research on the law of gravity. And for Hawking, gravity was a reason not to believe in God, as I just said to you. So here is Newton thinking that, as he wrote in his brilliant book, Principia Mathematica, one of the most famous books in the history of science, and he put in the cover of it, he hoped that a thinking person would find reason to believe in a deity in his book, including his description of the law of gravity. And Stephen Hawking comes to the exact opposite conclusion on the basis of the law of gravity. That's fascinating, especially if you're an Irishman. I love that kind of intellectual challenge. How do you account for Hawking, who says you must choose between science and God, you can't have both, and Newton, who had both? So we'll think just a little bit about that. Let's think, what does the law of gravity explain? Now, I'll tell you what it doesn't explain. Gravity. And if you've read Newton, hopefully in Latin, I struggled with that just a little, but his famous statement, non fingo hypothesi, I do not feign hypotheses. It means this, Newton is being asked about the nature of gravity. I don't know. You see, the law of gravity tells you how to work out the consequences, say, of the attraction between heavy bodies. And it's accurate enough, without Einstein's corrections even, for you to land people on the moon and set satellites circumnavigating the Earth. But the law of gravity doesn't explain gravity. Now here's something very important that took me a long time to get this. That when someone comes along and says, I have an explanation for this phenomenon, let's say the law of gravity, it's a law of something. That explanation, even within science itself, is rarely complete. Now that will help modify, I'm going to give you an example or two, just to round this home. And perhaps, that we can consider, for example, this. Why is the water boiling? And you have an explanation in terms of the physics of heat. Putting it in ordinary language, the heat energy stored in the Bunsen burner flame, the gas flame, is being conducted through the copper base of the kettle. It's agitating the molecules of water and making them boil. That's a scientific explanation. But there's another one. The kettle's boiling because I would just love a cup of tea. Now, think about those explanations. They're different. But you see, they don't contradict. They don't conflict. They complement. And they're both necessary for a full explanation. And which is the more important? Well, in the laboratory, the one in terms of the physics of heat is the most important. But outside the lab, people have been enjoying tea for millennia before they understood anything about the transfer of heat. This is so elementary. But why is it then that some leading intellects in our society claim that the scientific explanation is the only valid one? It's like saying, look, there are two explanations for a motor car. There's automobile engineering, the laws of physics, and internal combustion. And there's Henry Ford. Please choose. Well, when I say that in the school, but sir, the kids immediately say, you need both. Of course you need both. But the explanations, both necessary, they don't conflict because they're not the same kind of explanation. And this gives me great insight into understanding why Richard Dawkins is wrong when he says the God explanation is the same as the science explanation, so you must choose one or the other. No, it isn't. That's like saying the explanation in terms of the human agent or their desire to have a cup of tea is the same as the heat physics explanation. It isn't. And that takes a great deal of the heat out of the question, if you don't mind the vague pun. Because we need to understand the same is true of the universe. God no more competes with good natural sciences as an explanation of the universe than Henry Ford competes with the law of internal combustion as an explanation of the motor car. And incidentally, no amount of study of the motor car, you won't find Henry Ford, will you? But you can't explain its origin without it. So sometimes simple analogies can lead us along a path to understand what really is going on in this kind of situation. There are different levels of explanation, and normally the crude way of putting it is that science deals with the how explanations, and philosophy, theology, and the rest of them deal with the why explanations. But you need to qualify that, because scientists often use the word why, but they're not thinking of the why of purpose. I want a cup of tea. They're thinking of why is that wheel there? Why is that pipe attached to that? Why is that organ there? It's the why of function. So how and why of function are the province of the natural sciences. The why of purpose goes beyond them. And of course, if you reject the multi-dimensionality of the nature of explanation, then you just get into a colossal confusion. And many people are there today. They perpetuate what's called the conflict myth that science and God are in competition. And you know, historians of science have long since dismissed the iconic stories like the dispute between Galileo and the Catholic Church, or the dispute between Huxley and Wilberforce and the Natural History Museum. They've long since dismissed those as evidence that science and faith in God are at war. The historian of science, Colin Russell, wrote this: the common belief that the actual relations between religion and science over the last few centuries have been marked by deep and enduring hostility is not only historically inaccurate, but is actually a caricature so grotesque that what needs to be explained is how it could possibly have achieved any degree of respectability. You see, a little bit of history can help us here. An art subject, Geisteswissenschaft, but a very rational discipline. And early on in my life, I came across C.S. Lewis. In fact, I'm so old, I used to listen to a lecture at Cambridge, which experience I've never forgotten. But Lewis, talking about Whitehead was a brilliant philosopher. His view of the reason for the rise of modern science in the 16th and 17th centuries. And Lewis summarizes it like this: men became scientific because they expected law of nature. And they expected law of nature because they believed in a legislator. And you see, far from Galileo, Kepler, Newton, Clerk Maxwell, Bagot, Babbage, Faraday, and so on, far from their faith in God hindering their science, it was the motor that drove it. And you can see why. If you are convinced that there is a creator God behind this universe who built into it regularities then you might feel that science was worth doing. Kepler said, we're thinking God's thoughts after him. And that's the view I take. That the more we do of science, the more we understand of the universe, the more we can admire the genius of the God that did it. You see, when Newton discovered his law of gravity, he didn't say, oh, I've now got a law of gravity, I don't need God. No, what he said was, what a genius of the God who did it that way. The more he understood of the workings of the universe, the more he admired the God that did it. We're in Oxford University. The founding fathers of Oxford University lived long before Isaac Newton. But they saw no contradiction between learning, science was called natural philosophy in the early days, in all branches of learning, they saw no contradiction between that and belief in God, and so they gave our university the motto, Dominus Illuminatio Mea, God is my illumination. What I'd really like to discuss as we come to a close now, because this clock appears to have gone twice as fast as it should, is to scotch the idea in your heads that there's actually a conflict between science and God. It should be obvious that that can't be the case. Why do I say obvious? Well, take the Nobel Prize in Physics. A few years ago, it was won by Peter Higgs, a Scotsman. A few years before that, it was won by Bill Phillips, an American. They're both brilliant scientists. Science doesn't divide them. They're both at the top of the tree. But they're very different. Higgs is an atheist. Bill Phillips is a Christian. So where's the conflict? It's not between science and God. It's between two worldviews. The worldview of atheism and the worldview of theism. And there are brilliant scientists on both sides. It's an interesting statistic that approximately 65% of all Nobel Prize winners between 1900 and 2000 believe in God. It's an absolute myth to think that it's impossible to believe in God and science as well. So in conclusion, I would just like to say that the more I have investigated this, the more dangerous I see this notion that science and the natural sciences are the only way to truth. Because people will in the end discover that they don't deal with the biggest question of our lives, our meaning, our loves, whether this universe has a creator or not. You've got to go, as Medawar says, to theology and philosophy to find answers to those questions. My final point is this. I find atheism incoherent, and I can address that in more detail if you want to know why. I think it undermines rationality. But you see, going along with Newton and those early scientists, I find that my science and my mathematics sit extremely comfortably with the following statement. In the beginning was the Word. And the Word was with God, and the Word was God. The same was in the beginning with God. All things came to be through him. And without him, nothing came to be that came to be. In the atheist worldview, mass energy, or now nothing, is primary, and everything else, including mind, is derivative. In the Christian worldview, it's the exact opposite. Mind is primary, God, the Word, and mass energy and everything else is derivative. I'm excited to live in a word-based universe. Evidence of it seen in the mathematical intelligibility of the universe. We do science with special words, mathematical words, to physics works, chemistry works, and so on. But we've lived to discover that within our biological natures, there is, ironically, the longest word that we've ever discovered, and that's the human genome. 3.4 billion letters long in exactly the right order. And you know, when you look at words, and there are several very short words up on the wall here, I see one on my right, it says chorus, C-H-O-R-U-S, six letters. Do you know, immediately when I see that, I realize that whatever processes, scientific processes are behind the creation of that notice, there's a mind behind it. Why? Because it has a word of six letters long. And all of us, when we see words, when we see things that carry semiotic meaning, we know that physics and chemistry doesn't produce that meaning. And so I conclude, both as a scientist and a Christian, that this explanation given at the beginning of John's Gospel resonates brilliantly with the very first statement in the Bible: in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. Scientism has nothing to say to that. Thank you very much indeed.